Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply.
I was just told some of the greatest words I've ever heard. It's 100% Hockey with Mollard and Shannon. Right before we hit record, John Shannon said, whatever you want. John Shannon never said that to me before going on the air, on television, on a podcast, on the radio, ever. Whatever you want.
Go ahead.
Really?
Whatever
okay.
You want.
Mark Messier is going to join us a little bit. I want to know if he gets nervous before he comes on TV. I know he's a Hall of Famer. I know he's done everything, but from a, like, inside our world, selfishly, I want to know if Mark Messier gets nervous.
You get nervous?
Yeah. Anxious, excited. Yeah. Not really, I guess, maybe not nervous.
Yeah.
Maybe a blend of it all, which I still love. I love having that rush before I go on the air. Do you get nervous?
Not anymore. Not anymore. Not with TV. First 4 or 5 years, I was petrified. But after that, I don't know. I think something happened that it was almost like a switch got flicked. And then I realized that if I'm just myself, I don't try to be an announcer, which is what I try to tell everybody that I work with in teaching them. I said, you know, be yourself. Don't be an announcer. I actually finally took my own advice, and it changed everything for me, and it became much more fun to do.
I had a boss at Sportsnet once told me, don't be myself. They told me,
I can understand.
Said, don't be you.
I can understand that. I can understand it because you can be a little bit of a, you know.
It was a true story. They told me, don't be you.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you ever since you called Bettman your BFF, you screwed it up.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
You screwed it up.
We're good buddies. Gary loves me. We're tight.
Yeah.
we're into the Four Nations bye week. I want to really do a little bit of a dive into that, but Mark's just joined the green room, so I want to get over to him. I don't want to keep him waiting. This is
by the way, just if anybody wants to understand the schedule, because I didn't really understand the schedule. I tweeted it out on Monday morning what the schedule was and the different rules. There's a few different rules for Four Nations. So
yeah, they're all 3-point games.
Well, there, in fact, there's could be a 4-point game, couldn't there?
No.
Oh
no, you get
they're all 3-point games. Yeah, you're
three
right.
Points for a regulation win, and then 2 and 1 for another if it goes overtime or a shootout.
Yeah,
which I think is the groundwork for the National Hockey League going forward. This is an NHL event. They're trying this out, and I think we will go to a 3-point regulation win in the future.
I don't.
Well, you are going to really have to prepare yourself for the day when you come on here and you say, Mallard, you're right.
No, because
we've done it.
First of all, I would never say Mallard. I would say Darren, because you know what I think about nicknames. And I think what we would lose is we would actually see the disparity in the quality of teams, and we wouldn't have playoff races. I think what the system that is in place right now has done a very good job, and I say this in a positive way, artificially, of creating playoff races. So it's great. Playoff races are fantastic. So we should enjoy this system of games and this system of points. And lots of people could say, no, we want 3-point games. Well, what you're going to have is you are going to have a giant disparity of the haves and the
have
nots.
Have you run the numbers on this?
Have I?
Yeah.
No.
Because I think it's... I don't know whether it's as extreme as what you traditionalists believe.
Hold on. Traditionalists, there wouldn't be a point for overtime losses. Traditionalists would be you win or lose, and there's nothing. Then
okay,
there's
you
no tie,
liberal
so there's no points.
Traditionalists.
Oh, don't go there.
No,
do not
I,
go there.
I meant that. I didn't mean it politically. I meant it as.
Oh, yeah. Don't go there. We don't go there.
Don't make this political.
I didn't. You said it.
Mark's coming up. Will you call him Mess?
No, not his nickname.
Well, it is.
No.
Will you call him Moose?
I don't know. I haven't decided yet. We'll go to the break. We'll surprise him.
Coming up, 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon and Moose. Usually it comes naturally when we introduce our guests, how I'm going to phrase it. But this one's difficult because he's a Hall of Famer. But
seriously? It's
star.
Difficult?
Well,
all you have to do is say, here's Mark Messier.
I know, but he's a TV star now.
No. Here's Mark Messier.
Yeah.
And here, actually, this is one of those times, and you're going to get mad at me. You could actually say, "Hi, Moose. How you doing?"
I was going to go Mess.
Well, what do you prefer, Mess or Moose?
Well, I think it's two different nicknames. Moose is more known in Canada, and Mess is more in the States, I guess.
Well, where did Moose come from?
But great.
What do you mean? Where did the Moose come from? Did you see him play?
I know, but just for people that don't know, because we are dealing with new audiences.
Oh, beautiful.
My brother
yes.
Went away to play in Denver University. He came back at Christmas, his first or second year, and I started playing junior hockey, and I had grown a little bit and started getting a little stronger, and he came and was able to watch a game, and he goes, "Oh my God, you look like a bull moose playing out there."
So, and then it stuck.
And then it stuck ever since. So all my friends call me Moose, and yeah.
Well, for the record, Mark, I don't. I'm a non-nickname advocate. So for me to call you the Moose is got to be something special.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. Well, I appreciate it. And great to be on with you guys.
So you've got the National Hockey League season that you're dialed in on, and now you've got the Four Nations face-off. You played internationally for Canada. You know the best on best back when it was really hot with the Soviets. What's your take on a Four Nations tournament that doesn't have a trophy but does allow us to see the best on best? So it's kind of a hybrid in a way. Are you still all in?
Oh, yeah, I'm all in on it. Like I said before we started, there's so many storylines that are compelling on every team, matchups, players that have never played best on best, players are going to get a chance. We're going to get a chance to see some of the best players playing together, playing against each other. I know what international hockey did for me, being in the dressing room with some of the greatest players ever play the game, rubbing shoulders, learning, watching, listening. It was massive for my own confidence. It was massive for my own career. It was massive for my own learning to how to play the game, how to prepare for the game. These guys that walk away, that play in this tournament, will walk away from them better players because of it.
So when you were in the dressing room, when you were looking around, you're saying, holy smokes, I don't belong here. Who are you looking at?
Everybody at the time. I remember my first All-Star game in 1980, and that's a far departure from something like this, but my first All-Star game, I think it was 81, 82, somewhere in there. And, you know, players that we grew up watching, you know, all the Islanders were in there, the Canadians, Larry Robinson. I mean, it was as a young player, you can't even believe you're in there. And I got the first chance to represent Canada in 1984.
Right.
I think the thing that struck me the most was just being how proud I was to wear the Maple Leaf. I had never had a chance in junior to play any kind of, I didn't play at a high level in junior at all. In fact, I hardly even played junior. So I didn't have the opportunity to play for, you know, world juniors or anything like that. So here I am in 1984, you know, back then, you know, Russia, Canada, U.S. was not quite as powerful as they are now. So it was really kind of U.S. or, I mean, Soviets against Canada. And there was a lot at stake for for bragging rights back then, as you'd say. But for me, just you know, having the chance to play at that level of hockey, there's no weak links when you're in international hockey and you're taking the best 13 forwards, best 12 forwards, best six defensemen. I mean, everybody's good. There's no weak links. The pace of the play is incredible. The talent, the skill level, you know, the smallest mistakes, the margin for errors become so small because players are so good, they can take advantage of it. That's why for me as a hockey fan, watching hockey now is so compelling, is just how these teams are going to be able to come together so quickly. And the team that actually can mesh the quickest is probably going to have the best chance to win, in my opinion.
We're going to get back to that. We're going to get back to that because I think the Swedes and the Finns might have an advantage. How do you mesh so quickly? I mean, when you guys never played together prior to in 84 at the Canada Cup, you guys didn't, there was a short training camp, but not much. And how do you set your rivalries aside?
Well, a couple things there. One is that it's really important when you pick these all-star or these all-star selections that you actually pick the best team. It's easy to get seduced into picking the best players, but don't necessarily translate into the best team. And in such a quick turnaround, you would hope that there would be a lot of synergy between the players that they pick. I'm never going to second guess the selection because it's, you can't win unless you do win. But, you know, Hyman off with McDavid is just an example of where you get instant synergy with players. You know, how are they going to find that in this quick tournament with McDavid? So I think little subtle things like that can make a difference. And to your point, the Swedes and the Finns, they play a lot together.
Right.
Through the years growing up, international juniors, world championships, goes on and on and on. But I think the players are adaptive enough. I think they're smart enough. I think they're skilled enough. And I think the hockey IQs are all there. That's all there. But you can't replace those reps, those instinctive reps. I mean, I played with Glenn Anderson on my right side for how many years? Wayne played with Yeri for how many years? Yeah, we interchanged wingers on the left side. But that uncommon that feeling of that instinctual feeling of knowing exactly what he's going to do, where he's going to be, what he's going to do when he gets a puck, you can't replace that without time. And the rivalry thing, John, to your question, that's easy. Everybody's a competitor when you're out in the ice playing against each other. The more fascinating thing are the guys that play together now that now have to actually go up against each other and take no prisoners. So all those things combined is what makes it so compelling. There's just so many storylines that are going to go into this, and the winner the winning team that comes out of this is going to definitely have to earn it.
Interesting you bring up the meshing on the ice and trying to read off some chemistry and little quirks or abilities that a player has, and if you're playing with them new. I don't know what Coop's plan is for the first couple of practices or any of the coaches' plans, but would you do any scrimmaging, like just light scrimmaging, just to get people used to or test some of that?
Yeah, I think this is all going to be on the fly, to be honest with you. I think, to answer your question, yes, I think they'll have some light scrimmage and just to get some familiarities. I think the most important thing is actually how they're going to actually, the systems that they're going to implement in the neutral zone, on the forecheck, in the defensive zone, that's going to have to be, you know, pretty cut and dry. You know, it's not always the best team that wins. It's the team that's playing the best as a team wins championships. You know, all that's going to have to be I'm sure they've been sending out information to these players from a long time ago about things that they're going to do or try to do as implement as far as systems play is concerned. But you can't win on instinct. You can't win just freewheeling it there. You have to play connected hockey, and that's going to be a challenge for all these teams.
You know, one of the other aspects of this is that, you know, a guy like Mark Stone, Mark Stone plays 20 minutes a night?
Yeah.
Brad Marchand plays 20 minutes a night. Travis Konecny plays 21 minutes a night. Connor might play 23.
All top power play, too.
Right. So you can't put 12 forwards on the power play. You can't put 12 forwards on the ice all the time. These guys, and I say this respectfully, they all have egos. They all know what their roles are on their club teams, but some of them are going to play 12 minutes. And that's how much of a challenge is, I mean, when you're sitting on the bench saying, well, I can do that. I can get out there. Well, it's not your turn.
Yeah. Well, that is, you know, the challenges of the coaching staff that's in front of them. It's a challenge for a player to, I don't think it's a challenge for the player to accept the role that he's going to be given on, in this environment. I think that's going to come easy. I think the challenge for the player is going to be to stay in the game when he's used to playing every other shift or every, you know, staying,
right.
You know, like you say, 20 minutes. You know, you go long times in between shifts. Your role on this team is going to be different. You might be a power play guy. Now they might ask you to be a checker. And that's why it all gets down to the selection of, you know, you got to have players for every scenario out there that are used to playing that role. You can't take a guy that hasn't been a checker for 10 years and expect him to go out there and kill penalties and check. He can do that, but the reps just aren't there right now. So for me, the selection process is fascinating. How they're going to put it all together, I can only tell you that there's been exhaustive discussions amongst the general managers and the managers of the team and the coaching staff of how they're going to construct all these teams. And ultimately, in the end, someone's going to be proven right with the selection, because they're going to ultimately be the winner. And like I said, you can't win unless you win. Everybody's going to be second-guessed if you don't come out on top of this.
You know, there are lots of players that didn't get selected to the club. And I guess Mark Scheifele for Canada is at the top of that list, because he's having an unbelievable season. And he sees his teammates go to the tournament for other countries. So in 1997, November of 97, you don't get chosen for Canada. What would you tell Mark Scheifele about the learning curve about this, and how you manage that? Because that, I'm sure that hurt you in 97, didn't it?
Well, it did. I was, you know, towards the end of my career, I still felt I could have been a role player. Obviously, I wasn't going to be, you know, one of the leaders on the team as far as being an on-ice leader anyways. But I still felt that I could have helped support in a support role. I grew up playing a support role. I knew that role very well. But those are the tough decisions that have to be made, and not everybody's going to be happy. I had to accept it. It was one of the things that I actually missed in my career was playing in the Olympics, and that was probably my only chance to do it. I didn't get picked, and that's the way it was. That's the way it is. You got to, country first.
Were you that pragmatic in November of 97?
Actually, I was. I took it pretty well, to be honest with you. I understood that they have tough decisions to make. They picked the team that they felt was going to be the best team, like we had just talked about. And as a player, you got to accept it. I mean, there's, you know, and Scheifele is one of the ones. I think Hyman is an interesting choice not to have him with McDavid, because they play so well together. And Hyman is a high end player. He's hard on the forecheck. He's hard on pucks. He hunts pucks down for McDavid. I mean, that synergy you just can't replace in a quick, short amount of time. But Scheifele, but there's how many other guys are just,
oh no, you're right,
incredible hockey players. And that's the beauty, I guess, of Team Canada. We got a spoil of riches, and the managers and coaches are tasked with picking 12 of the best. You know, to think about it, 12 forwards in Canada. You get named on that team. That's pretty lofty goals and expectations.
Billy Guerin had the same problem. Let's face it, Billy Guerin had the same problem for the U.S. team. There's no question.
1,000%. There's so many great players in the U.S. now. And like I said, it's a thankless job. And the only way you win is to win.
What are your expectations of Connor McDavid?
Well, I think he's I said this a few times, and I think I might have even said it to John over the years. I don't think I've seen a superstar that works, has ever worked per shift, per game, per season harder than Connor McDavid. I'm not sure if I've ever seen him take a shift off. I don't think there's a harder working superstar in any sport if you really break it down into the productivity and the output. on a day-to-day, on a game-to-day game basis, on a shift-to-shift, it's incredible, actually. I expect McDavid to do what he's done throughout his career. Make big plays, big time. Last year, going to the finals, you guys know, when you go to the finals and either you win or you lose, it changes you as a player. He has such a better understanding of what it takes to win, both physically, mentally, strategically. And so I think that he's going to bring that into this tournament. I think he's going to be a real important leader for Team Canada, both on and off the ice. I think he's respected universally amongst his peers, which will automatically give him that, you know, will be put in that leadership position. But I think his more important than that, though, I think is the experience and the trajectory of his career, culminating with that incredibly heartbreaking, gut-wrenching loss last year, going into seven games and fighting back from 3-0, that has changed him forever as a player, as a winner, as a leader. And I think he's going to be able to draw on that in this tournament.
Take a break. Be back with more with Mark Messier on 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon.
NHLShop.com, the official online store of the National Hockey League and the world's largest selection of officially licensed NHL fan gear with unique one-of-a-kind designs by Fanatics and all the latest styles for every NHL team. Don't miss out. Shop now and get today's special offer. NHLShop.com, a Fanatics experience.
Back with Mess, or as John calls him, Moose.
No, I call him Mark. I call him Mark because, you know, I'm anti-nickname. But I called him Moose for you. Because
really?
I know you love nicknames.
I do. Well, that's
I hate
part
it.
Of our vernacular, our communication.
No, yeah.
Do you have a favorite in this tournament, Mark, going back to the Four Nations?
Well, obviously Canada. It'd be hard to get off Canada. But I have to say, you know, we felt the U.S., the emergence of the U.S. coming for a long time, ultimately until they beat us in 90, was it 96 in the World Cup? The U.S. hockey program has just exploded. You know, they're getting players from all over now. If you like the game of hockey, you can play. And that presents a huge challenge because of the population. In the United States for Canada, but you know, if you go down the rosters, could you say one Canada, US, is there one team that's more talented than the other? I don't think so. To me it all gets down to, from my experiences, is how well can a team come together as a team, play connected hockey, be able to rely on each other to be in the position in the spots on the ice that they're supposed to, be disciplined. Don't take bad penalties. You know, these shortened series like this, everything is just magnified. Every shift is a difference maker. So I think the talent level is pretty even. It's more of it going to be about who executes the game plan better.
So you don't get a break. 92 players don't get a break. But do you think the rest of the league's enjoying the break?
Yeah, I think there's always a nice opportunity for the players at this time of year to take a break. I think it benefits us as fans, to be honest with you, that the players come back somewhat refreshed. You know, January, February have always been the dog days of the season. Mm-hmm. You don't see the light at the tunnel. You know, you're hurt, you're banged up, you're injured. If you're losing, it's tough mentally. So I think this break, more than physically, I always get back to, you know, the players are in such incredible condition. It's never really about, you know, fatigue physically. It's more fatigue mentally that can wear teams and players down. And I think this break is going to be better. And I think the recipients, the benefactors of that are going to be the fans, because I think we're going to be able to see, you know, refreshed teams come back down the stretch and then into the playoffs.
Yeah, it's a sprint. There's 2 weeks before the trade deadline when the season resumes, and then you're right into it.
It is. We just did the telecast the other night. It's playoff hockey in February. The parity of the league, eight teams that are realistically fighting, or six teams anyways, fighting for those last two wild card spots. It's just every game now, your scoreboard watching in February, it's just amazing. It's awesome, but it's amazing.
You enjoying the TV?
Loving it.
Yeah.
Loving it. I didn't know what to expect going in. And it's just been so gratifying in a way to be back into the game, connected to the game. The job itself has been a bit massive learning curve for me. One of the things that I realized over the first 3 years, that instinctually I'm always so protective of my players and being critical because of the impact that it can have. But I realize now after 3 years that my new team is the audience, and I have to be really kind of honest in the assessment of the game. And that's been helpful for me. I'm more comfortable, obviously. I've learned a lot more, but more importantly than anything, I'm just more confident in really kind of looking at the game, looking at the situation, and being honest with the viewer of what we're seeing, and hopefully shedding some insight into it.
You're funny you say that, because about a month ago, you were as critical as I've ever seen you on television. And I say this respectfully, you and Wayne have been such great proponents and advocates for the game. You're very protective of the game. But you were not protective of the New York Rangers when they were going through their strife earlier in the season. Do you think they've turned it around?
Well, I don't know if it was a criticism or it was just a statement of reality. I think you can always work around the fringes of teams and make tweaks and all that. When you start to talk about the core and you start talking and changing the core mid-season, that is a completely different animal from a team that's actually saying and wanting to win the Stanley Cup. It presents massive challenges, and it's just reality. I think, and it wasn't me who said it. I think the general manager, Drury, was the one that said that changes needed to be made in the summer.
Right.
And they started that process, but I'm just telling you, from my perspective and my experience there, that the core is absolutely critical and key to a championship team. And that core and that has to have, you know, years of playing together. It sets the culture of the organization and the team. The amount of reps that you see players that have played together for years, like Yeri and Wayne or me and Andy, and, you know, the core is just so meshed together that everybody else that comes into the franchise is basically feeding off that energy and grabbing an oar and starting a row, as we used to say. But so I don't think I was that critical. I think it was just a matter of fact of what was happening with the Rangers. And of course, everybody has feelings. Players have feelings. Mm-hmm. And so when you start talked about trades and getting moved and all that kind of stuff, it is going to have an impact on you as a player. It's going to have an impact on you, on your best friends in the team and the core of the team. And then you see players get traded. That is what has been disrupted for the New York Rangers. Now, I said there's that it can go two ways. They can actually lay down and it can completely go sideways, or they can fight back and figure out how they're going to put it all back together. And I think the Rangers have actually done a pretty good job of that. They are playing way better hockey than they have. I think they've shaken off the cobwebs from some of the things that happened. And my guess is they're the best team that's not in the playoffs currently. And I think they should be able to outpace the other teams and get into the playoffs. And once they're in the playoffs, you know, they got a great goaltender and they got some great players on the team. Then whoever knows, it's really about the matchup in the first round. And
the other story from this season comes from Vancouver. And I was critical of how management handled the situation. I do appreciate the coaching staff keeping that team in a playoff position, despite everything that's been going on. That's been really impressive. How did you view, and did you ever have any experiences like that where it seeped into the room, and how did you deal with it?
You know, it's interesting you say that. I don't remember. I remember players coming in and not fitting in for the expectations and the culture that we had created. And it was so obvious. And that's why it's so critical to have a strong culture in a team. If you don't, players can come and go, and you just never know if they're good or the culture's bad. And they could be right. But if in my experience is that when the expectations were clearly defined from players, what we needed from you on and off the ice, how we traveled, how we played, how we conducted ourselves, in the community, all the things that are so important that go into a team's success, once that's etched in stone, and it's not arbitrary, it is just the way it is. It is or it isn't. And if you can't live up to that, then you make the decision for us that you can't be a part of this winning team, because it's not easy playing in a winning environment. It's pure hell, to be honest with you. Everybody thinks they see that, the Stanley Cup being raised at the end. It's a lot of fun. Well, getting there is pure hell. And if you're not willing to sacrifice, if you're not willing to fit in, if you're not willing to change your own behaviors and patterns to fit in, then this probably isn't the right place for you.
Where did
Fortunately for me, I never had that from the core. There were times on the fringes that was to happen, but not from the core, which happened in Vancouver. So that would have been new for me.
I was going to say where, I mean, I know the guys that you worked with and for, but when you're in the room, don't the players create the culture?
1,000%. The leadership is massive, and of course you're working symbiotically with the manager, general manager, the ownership. It all starts with ownership, passed down to the general manager who sets the vision, and then you hire the coach to kind of work towards a vision, and then the players that you come in, that you bring in, you're all working together to create how you think you're going to get to. Sorry, you're all going to. Sorry,
That's okay.
my dogs are barking. You're
No,
all
no,
working.
we're
I
big
wanted
on
them
it.
to
We're big
jump
on
up.
pets on this show. It's okay.
Oh, good. They're fighting over a bone.
That's the best.
So I think the and then the players have to figure it out themselves. And I think one of the things that might be missing nowadays is a lot more peer pressure amongst themselves. And the coach can say anything he wants, the general manager can say anything he wants, but the guys that inside the room that are looking across from each other on a day-to-day basis, you can't fool them. There's no fooling them. They know if you're cutting it short. They know if you're not paying attention. They know if you're not doing the extra. They know if you're not living the right kind of lifestyle to be successful. And anything other than your best is never good enough. And the players have to hold each other accountable ultimately. And they have to work in conjunction with the team and the organization, all that. But the players inside that dressing room, that's where the rubber meets the road, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you had two pillars in that dressing room, a really good player and a really strong personality and part of the leadership group. I'm not sure it could have played out any differently than it did necessarily because of that, in the
Where
sense, well, in
are you talking about?
Vancouver. Vancouver, sorry.
For myself personally,
No, I was just talking
with
about
JT and Pedersen.
with JT and Patterson.
For JT and that was very interesting scenario, and it's hard for me to comment because I don't know JT very well. I don't know Pedersen at all. I don't know the situations behind it, so it's really hard for me to comment, but that was definitely disruptive. It was disruptive for sure.
You would have loved playing with JT Miller, Mark.
With JT,
Oh yeah, you would have loved playing with him. Yeah.
well, I was in the interview process with him when he got drafted by the Rangers, and sorry, go on,
That's
come
okay, Mark. What
here.
kind of dogs are they?
Two labs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's the best. What are the names?
Yeah. Well, this is. You want to see?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's the other way. It's okay. Coda and DeBo. They're two
Oh,
black labs. Yeah.
wow, cool.
Oh.
Yeah, that was really unfortunate. Both great players.
No, but you said you were in the interview process for JT when you were working with the Rangers.
Yeah, and it was interesting to sit there and as a young player. And I remember leaving the interview with him. I said, that guy's going to be a player. He was indifferent. He wasn't affected. He wasn't trying to be anybody who he wasn't. He wasn't trying to impress anybody. It just came and appeared to me that he just wanted to play hockey.
Right.
And, you know, at that point, having seen a lot of players come and go over the years, he just seemed to me that he was going to find a way to, if the talent was there, which I think everybody thought, he was going to find a way to play really well in the league.
So I want to pivot a little bit here, because you talked about, we talked about Connor and what his role. I haven't heard your thoughts on the Amazon documentary series where Connor goes ballistic after, I believe it's game two in Florida, that the team is not winning any of the games, and he's in the room and he's telling guys that we got to get our act together. What'd you make of that?
Well, I think it's just part of the maturation of a leader. And I think, you know, leadership is learned, as you guys know, it's through experience, both positive and negative. And then I think there has to be an innate feeling for what needs to be done at the right time or what needs to be said. It can come in many different forms. And I think for me that when a leader like in that moment can be that raw, that emotional, care that much, if there's not a response from the team after that, I would say that you start to need to look at some different players. And they did get the response. And sometimes it can come in many different forms. You know what I mean? It was, I don't think it was planned. I don't think it was premeditated. I think it was, he saw the opportunity. He saw the opportunity slipping away. He knew he needed to do something. And I don't think it was like I said, premeditated what was going to happen. I think that just came out so organically and naturally. And I think players, if they weren't all in, they were all in after that.
So that's my professional segue to talk about Game 7. Because that was a Game 7, and so you were the executive producer of a series for Amazon about Game 7s. Obviously, the one that I think Darren and I probably enjoyed most was Game 7 against the Flyers in 87. Was that a cultural moment for your team, too, in Game 7 in 87?
Yeah, it sure was. You think about everything that was at stake back then for us, you know, playing with the greatest player that ever played the game. We knew very early on in his career that he was just not playing the game for fun. He was playing the game to smash every record that he could to win championships and be recognized as the greatest player ever. And that's a different mindset completely. And when you're playing with someone like that, there's a big responsibility from the rest of us to kind of get in line and go along with it. And we had an amazing team of filled with incredible character that recognized it, but wanted to be along for that ride. And we loved Wayne, and we recognized the opportunity that we had as a team to be recognized as one of the greatest teams ever. 86 was a gut punch for us. Oof. I mean, it was just, you know, I mean, there was just no reason for us. But a funny thing happened on the way to a championship, as we've seen before. And it was a reckoning that we all had to kind of look at each other and say, well, what's next now? And so that next year was really from the moment we got to training camp, it was laser focus on getting back to the playoffs and winning another Stanley Cup, which we're able to do, and all the storylines that you talk about, that made that, you know, that docuseries so incredibly, exciting, mesmerizing, the Steve Smith, comeback from 86, the team coming back, unsure, winning in Game 7. It was awesome.
Did you have a feel before your Game 7s? Like a certain optimism, or was there an anxiousness, and maybe the ones that you look back, that one that didn't go your way?
You know, what I learned for me personally before any big game was to let all the emotions come into me and imagine all the scenarios, whether that was winning, and then I would imagine losing, and I would see what that would have looked like on the ice with the other team, carrying around the trophy, and that was all leading up to the game. As the game got closer, a lot of that started to get replaced. A lot of the bad side of the things that going sideways were replaced with more of the positive things that I wanted to happen or hope happened. And then that all gets misplaced, and then you just start thinking about the execution of what you need to do as a player, as an individual, and then what your responsibility is as a team. And as a leader, how are we going to get ourselves prepared for this, and what are the things that need to be said and reminders going into the game seven? So all the things that lead up to it, you know, the good and the bad that could potentially happen, then gets misplaced with execution. And that's what really enables you to focus and not get too far ahead of yourself and worry about the outcome, because your focus now is just on about the game plan and really kind of focusing on that as a team and as an individual. And then you can, you know, as we've heard everybody say it, now we can stay in the moment and just really kind of forget about all the what ifs and the great scenarios, you know, one way or the other.
Are there comparisons of game sevens in other sports? Like in the series that you were the executive producer on, there were other sports. There's only one hockey show. So but all the others, were there comparisons that you dealt with?
Well, we had two, we had the Rangers 94 yes, it. I think every game seven is always about how you got there. I think the journey is what is so compelling when you talk about a game seven. And when you get to a game seven, you talk about two franchises that have gone through this incredible journey, and they're all different. And in the end, John, as you know, it's all about the people. Mm-hmm. And how do you inspire, how do you motivate people to come together for a collective goal like the Stanley Cup or the NBA or the MLB And I think that why game sevens are so compelling, because obviously it's a win or go home. What's at stake makes it compelling. Who's going to be the hero? All the things that are just so and I think one of the things that makes game seven so watchable is that you don't even have to be a sport fan to get into the storyline. It transcends the games in some point, because the where the players have come from, their journey to get there as individual and as teams just becomes so riveting. And you know, John, all the years you've been covering the game and what it meant to players to win and the heartache that they suffered to get there and tragedies that have come along the way. And it's just so rich of being, you know, so much heart goes into it, I guess, you know, and I think that's what, where game sevens become so riveting.
Well, I mean, you did it more than once, because you did it with the Rangers winning 2-7s, right? And then of course, back in 86 and 87, we were all there. So we lived Steve's agony. And yep. I mean, agony. And then I can only imagine, and it happened to you with the Rangers too, I can only imagine after game six, the flight home. The flight home must not have been very much fun.
Well, that's when we all got to be goaltenders and had short memories. Yeah, sometimes, you know what, you just need to turn the page. At that time of year, there's no use, you know, sitting there and feeling sorry for ourselves. I think the moment that game six lost in both instances, you start focusing on what needs to change, what, you know, resetting your mindset. You know, thankfully, in both cases, I think there was 2 days in between.
There was.
Which really gives you a moment to travel the day and kind of get your mind off and come back to the next rink, you know, have a good practice, and then really kind of start. And in the end, it's all about belief, as you know. You got to believe that you can win. And where does the belief come from? The belief comes from, you know, what you've done in the past. And in both cases, there, if you really looked at it analytically as a player, which we don't normally do, but as a player, now here I am 64, I can look at it from that lens. But, you know, there's no reason why the Oilers in 87 shouldn't have won game seven. And there's no reason why the Rangers in 94 shouldn't have won game seven. Now, should have and could have and would have is a lot different than actually making it happen. We had to go out and execute and play as well as we could. But if we did play our best hockey in both those games with the Oilers and Rangers, we felt good of our chances of winning those games. But we had to go do it. And fortunately for us, we were able to go do it. We had the experience in both scenarios to do it. We had the team to do it. We had the goaltenders to do it. And but as you know, funny things happen in sports, you know, and it's just nothing's a given. And we were playing against two resilient teams, the Flyers in 87 and the Canucks in 94, that were not going to lay down. They had great leadership. They had great coaching. They were resilient in every word and in every, you know, stretch of the word, resilient. Wow. They just would not go away. But ultimately, we were able to do it, which, you know, from our perspective, we're very happy about it.
We'll have a similar situation with the Four Nations, not a game seven, but a final game. Do you think you'll get the old feelings back when you're in the building?
Every time I walk into a building, especially in the playoffs, in the finals right. last year, I mean, I felt like I was getting ready for a game. You can't help but feel the tension to know what's at stake. You know what the bus ride feels like to the game. You know what the dressing room is like. You know what it's like getting, you know, going onto the ice, warm up. It just comes back so vividly that it just, you can't help but kind of get this feeling that comes over you. And I was on edge, you know, and I guess for us now, when we're, you know, doing those telecasts and with the amount of eyes that are on it, you want to have a good performance too. So all that combined was just so great to be a part of it.
I've never been in a room where you weren't the most confident guy. That you make us at ease, but you have that feeling and aura about you. Do you get nervous before you go on TV though?
I wouldn't say it's a readiness and I've learned to.
Was it different than at the start?
Sorry?
Was it different than at the start?
When you went up? At the start, I was too tied up in my head trying to talk about too many things in a short amount of time.
Overthinking.
And instead of just taking one point. But the problem is that I had and still have is that for anything that happens on the ice, there's 10 things that happen behind it that are so interesting, which is basically what you're talking about, the 10-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu. It's just not the arm bar that gets there. It's the way to set up the arm bar. It's the way to set up the whatever. I'm just using that as an analogy because yeah. I'm trying to, educate the fan on why things happen. Because if you're just watching the game and something happens, you look at the player, you look at this and say, well, why would he do that? But well, there's 10 things that happened before that. Unfortunately, in TV, we don't have time to set it up. So I have to be more succinct and more direct in my scenario that I'm trying to talk about. And that's just a learning curve, but I'm starting to feel, but to your point, I don't think it's a nervousness. I just think it's a readiness that you want to do a good job. I want to do a good job. And I really wanted to, you know, hopefully educate the listener into the nuances of the game. I think there's just the game is so beautiful just from a pure athletic standpoint, but there's so many nuances of the game and subtleties of the game that get missed just because we don't have time to really highlight it. And that's sometimes frustrating, but I try to do the best job I can at that.
Well, that's John's fault, the producer. He doesn't give us enough time to talk about the game.
You got to pay the bills.
Hey, we've given Marco plenty of time today.
And I still screwed it up.
Hey, you know what? Just be yourself. Just be yourself, man. You're too good not to be.
Yeah.
Well, John, yourself. I appreciate all your help over the time, too. Your text messages and your insight has been very helpful, so I appreciate that.
I bet his text messages to you are nicer than the ones to me.
Not necessarily.
That's you got to awesome. Be able to take some criticism in this game, whether it's good or bad, constructive criticism.
You do. Have fun, buddy. It's great to see you back in the game. We love it being able to lean into your experience and really enjoy this Four Nations face-off. And most importantly, say hi to Coda and Bo for us.
Yeah. I will for sure, you guys. Thank you. And are you guys going to be at Four Nations?
We will not.
No.
I'm enjoying the 2 week break from Vegas during the schedule, so I'm having some downtime. And John's just doing whatever.
Shoveling
John
snow.
Does.
That's all.
Yeah.
I know.
Shoveling snow. So. Well, great to be on with you guys. Thank you.
Appreciate
it. Be good, buddy.
Okay. Cheers, guys.
NHLShop.com, the official online store of the National Hockey League, and the world's largest selection of officially licensed NHL fan gear, with unique one-of-a-kind designs by Fanatics, and all the latest styles for every NHL team. Don't miss out. Shop now and get today's special offer. NHLShop.com, a Fanatics experience.
The comment about Connor McDavid was fascinating, about just what to expect from McDavid on this stage in best on best where he's playing for Team Canada.
You know, I think what came out of that for me was, first of all, it looks, Mark says he's 64. It looks like he could still play.
Oh,
I mean, right?
Okay. This will sound mean, but I'm going to put this into perspective. This is how I thought about it when Messier mentioned that his age is 64. When I was younger in life, I remember seeing people who are 64 and they were ancient. My belief was they were ancient. Mark Messier doesn't look ancient. It looks great.
Mark Messier looks fit.
Yes.
But to listen to Mark speak of Connor with such admiration was, to me, fascinating just to hear about work ethic. Because in my time around Mark, which began in 1979, I never saw anybody work harder than Mark Messier. And so for him to honor McDavid that way, that was a revelation for me.
He does believe Canada is the favorite.
Yeah, I don't. But
can you still play Canadian hockey and win? Or is there a Canadian hockey anymore?
Well, I mean, Canadian hockey is, you know, tough on the forecheck, a little physical.
I think we've met in the middle here.
Well, so this is a fascination for me is, and I've always done the comparison of two players. So when I was a kid, you know, black and white television, all the way to 1972 with the Summit Series, Canada versus Russia, the Russians played this fast flowing regrouping style of hockey that if they went, you know, if they didn't have the offensive move, they would regroup in their own zone. And as Canadians, we would just think this is horrific. How can you go backwards?
It's the modern day 3-on-3, or that was the past 3-on-3.
Well, and all we did was we hit, we were vicious. We were hit. It was, the game of intimidation. Well, I wonder now if we haven't adapted hockey to the Soviet system much more than the rest of the world has adapted to
ours. I agree.
But there's two guys, to me, that are prototypical of this. Sidney Crosby and Alex Ovechkin. Because we have in Ovechkin, for the duration of his career, one of the hardest hitting, one of the most relentless body-checking physical players in the history of the game. He should have been Canadian. Sidney Crosby, the thinker, you know, every nuance of the game, he plays more of a Russian-style game, a Soviet-style game from the 70s than Ovechkin does. It's quite a contradiction, you know. That's my sociology lesson for the day.
You bring up Sid. And
well, he's practicing today, so in Montreal. So
is Sid where Wayne was in 98?
Respectfully, no. I think Sid is far more mainstream than Wayne was in by 98. You know, I because And I don't know this for a fact, but you know, you had to wonder. I mean, Marc Messier didn't make the team in '98.
No.
And what would the team have looked like in Nagano without Wayne? And nobody.
Wayne wasn't the captain in
'98. No, I know. Yeah. Eric Lindros was. Mm-hmm. But the torch had been passed at that point, I think, from Wayne to others. Sidney Crosby, to me, and this is not a criticism of Wayne, but Wayne's back was gone, had gone bad by then. Wayne was, you know, he only lasted another year and a half at that point. You know, I can see Sid playing four more years. I really can. I can see he's just signed the 2-year deal. I can see him signing another one. He's just an amazing athlete. I also think that's the difference. Heck, you know, Nagano's 27 years ago. I think training has changed. I think how people look after themselves has changed. And therefore, I think
15 years, almost the day of the Golden Goal in Vancouver.
Yeah. But it speaks to, I think it speaks
crazy to
what
think
it,
that.
I think it speaks to what an amazing athlete.
Yes.
Sidney Crosby is, more than anything else.
I talked a lot of Team Canada today. Are you okay as we go on through the week to dial into Team USA?
Oh, we should. Absolutely.
Like, I'm right in the middle of that get to see Jack Eichel and Noah Hanifin every day, and I'm really excited about this tournament for Jack.
Well, you know, Jack has Jack, since he's gone to Vegas, is the athlete we expected to see. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't that in Buffalo, but he certainly has been that in Vegas.
I think it could be one of those aha moments.
Yeah.
For Jack Eichel, and he's done everything.
You know,
that you can think of, but this could be. Just, and he loves the big stage. He plays so well on the big stage.
Well, he's going to have a chance. And as I said earlier, I now know the schedule. It's Canada USA Saturday night.
Yep.
It is going to be wild
in Montreal.
In Montreal.
That would be cool.
Hmm.
Biggest Canada USA game in Montreal since 1996. Although
I guess I
played World Juniors, but
yeah, but. Pros, yeah. I got a good story about that one day too.
Really?
Yeah. I was 96. I was heavily involved in the World Cup in 96. Heavily involved. So, in fact, and who scored the winning goal for the Americans but a Canadian? It's great.
Right.
Brett Hull. So,
little tip. High tip.
Yeah, well, it might have been a high stick tip.
Video,
except
there's no way that we would turn that back, even in with video review of today.
Well, the problem was the handheld camera directly behind the net that was going to show that high stick had been moved to the Canadian dressing room for the celebration.
No.
Yep.
Who did that?
Well, I know who made the decision.
Really?
Yep. I know who made the decision.
It's never been out there.
I think I've told it a couple of times. Not to
I've
you.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, it's a true story. Yeah, we had Canada was up, right? Canada was up. And the Americans scored two quick goals. Boom, boom. And as I recall, gosh, it's 96. That's a long time ago. And we had moved the handheld camera to go into the Canadian dressing room. And it was directly behind the net. So you could have seen where Brett's stick was compared to the crossbar of the goal. But there wasn't a camera.
People's awareness, it wouldn't have been overturned anyway because there wasn't video review.
You sure?
No, but I was hoping you would back me up on that.
I don't know. Well,
I don't believe there wasn't a situation room in 96. No.
Oh, yeah, sure there were, because we would do goal reviews. There were goal reviews. There wasn't situation room, but there was people on site. Video review started in 1992. Video review started in 1992 with VHS machines, Darren. With VHS machines.
Like, it wasn't a coach's challenge or anything.
No coach's challenge.
I'll ask you, would that have been overturnable? not the proper
I think it
phrasing.
would. I think it would have been, yeah.
Well, I was hoping you were going to say no so I could not have that sitting in my gut all day.
It doesn't matter. By the way, there's a whole generation of American players that speaks of 96 and that great team, and winning that tournament, the World Cup of Hockey. They speak of 96 the way the previous generation speaks of 1980. And the influence of the 96 team, which was the American team in 96 was absolutely fantastic. That's what,
Keith Tkachuk, Billy Guerin, Doug Weight,
yeah.
Brett Hull, Mike Richter.
Brian Leach.
Right in, you know, we're further away from 96 than 96 was from 1980.
I know.
You
I
know, like
know.
that's how, like, America, and Jack Eichel said this to me. It's time. Like they've nibbled on the edges. They have to have another 1980, 1996 type moment.
Well, I think one of the realities of the American team, and what USA Hockey's done is that, internationally, at the pro level, not because junior level, the USA Hockey has become a dynamo.
I
Is
think they
that
passed Canada at the junior level.
so the challenge then becomes is how do you get the pros? Because if you look back at the contributions of the pro players to USA Hockey, they haven't been near as prolific as other programs. Not the women's program, not the junior program. You
What do you mean
know,
by that?
how many medals? You know, I mean, like you look at Nagano, you look at Salt Lake City,
Oh,
you look at Torino. Vancouver was the anomaly, and they got the silver medal there. You know, there were moments. We remember moments. We remember TJ Oshie in Sochi with the shootout stuff. But we don't remember the American team as being that, you know, successful internationally at that point. And where are they on? It's not near as important, but where are they with the World Championships in May? Are they a factor there? Most of them are still playing in the NHL by then, but that's okay.
Let's go down that path a little bit. But I do want to zero in on Team USA's
Yeah, we will.
Four Nations roster. And we'll
Okay.
see. All right. There's
Whatever you
John
want,
Shannon.
Darren. Whatever you want.
Can we put that on a t-shirt? 100% hockey. Whatever you want, Darren.
No, we're not doing that.
Millard and Shannon, along with Hugh McLaren. Thanks for listening. We'll be with you next time on 100% Hockey.